Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Bob Hoy from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Canadian and U.S. stock markets finally had a positive week. He comments on gold and crude. InsideTrackTrading.com CEO Eric Haddock gives us his take on what cycles are rising and declining in the markets. He tells us what he believes the cycles predict for interest rates and the U.S. dollar. KaiserResearch.com CEO John Kaiser tells us about what's been happening with the junior mining sector and how the worldwide demand for lithium could make it very interesting in the future. We'll talk to Bob Hoy right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Bob.
Yeah, and it has been an interesting week in the market.
Both the Canadian and U.S. stock exchanges ended the week up after weeks of losses. What's the story there, Bob?
Well, it just came down to being very oversold, and I'm looking down to it. It was really blasted out last week, sort of found some stability for a couple of trading days, and then itched up quietly and had a very good day today. Like, for example, let me get back to this other page. You had the Standard & Poor's Index up 3%, the NASDAQ up 3.3%, crude oil, hey, threes are all over the place. Threes are wild. Crude oil up 3%, and the U.S. dollar down a little at 104.2. That was down just a snick. And gold was, more or less unchanged on the day. So I think it is a relief rally. The markets have been heavily sold since the excited peak in January. And even like it was May was pretty heavy, and then just a week or so ago, those lows in May were taken out, which is quite discouraging. But at any rate, we're just going to say that it's a rebound. It could last for a week or so, but overall, in the stock market, that peak in January was very important. It had all kinds of enthusiasm with it. And our sentiment and momentum figures all became overdone when we made the call for a turndown in the stock market. There were indicators, the credit spreads had started to turn to widening. And then in April, we got a bad signal with the yield curve. And that's the difference between short rates and long rates. And when short rates rise above long rates, it's called an inversion. And on our charts back to 1857 in the U.S., every such inversion has been followed by recession. So I think things are slowing here. Base metal prices have been weak. The hot commodities that were up until into March, like base metals got a way up there, particularly with the immense an unusual short squeeze in nickel, and then they've come down, and now copper, and some people call copper Dr. Copper in the markets because it has a PhD in economics. But copper has weakened significantly, broken down, and some of the other commodities, which reached their peaks, March, April, May, are also turned down. So the notion that this runaway inflation is going to continue for some time, I think it's all in the market, and we've seen the high commodity prices. The commodity prices could have remained favorable into around mid-year, and but no rolling over. So this has been a fascinating market.
What's going on with gold?
Yeah, gold is neither here nor there. It was kind of unchanged today. But the main story in gold for decades has been is that the Federal Reserve is evil, and also the Bank of Canada, not to exclude. And I agree, because the only story they know is to inflate currency and credit, which boosts prices at various times. And but the gold bugs get it into their head that this is that what the central bankers are doing at the Federal Reserve is unique. But every central banker around the world has all taken the same courses and doing the same thing. So the story that gold is going to go to 10,000 because the U.S. dollar is going to go to zero, that has been the story for a long time, but it doesn't work. We've done different work. And what gold does during the final climax of a great financial bubble, and what, in the best way, in a consistent way to look at gold, is with the deflated price, where you adjust it for inflation. And on previous great financial bubbles, the real prices come down such that gold mining stocks underperform during the final ecstasy of a bubble in stocks, which they have done. And then the irony is that when the big market like New York rolls over and dies, it takes the gold stocks down with it. So, but now, in looking at the gold stocks now, and in particularly some that don't show up in an index, there's many small junior exploration stocks that have just been absolutely decimated. I mean, in the true sense of the word, decimated. So it looks like the correction or the major hit in the gold sector has been done. Now, how it settles out and starts the next rally, we haven't quite that one figured out yet. But this is now the opposite to in 2011, when all of the gold stocks were going up, and the gold pundits were, you know, gold was going to go to 10,000 and stocks and everything else. And that all registered all kinds of technical excesses, which we noted at the time. And I think, and we'll do a little more work on this, that the recent action in gold stocks is symmetrical with that. It's kind of like the opposite, but we'll have to do a little more work, a little more time, and we can do some work on the charts. But it's one of the most devastated gold markets I can recall seeing, something like, hey, way back to the early 1970s. So, but for the longer term, we like the gold sector, and we've been holding back, expecting that with a crack in the big stock markets, that the gold stocks would come down, and they have, much more so than I thought, well, particularly in many orphan juniors, they've come down much faster and further than I thought they could. But nonetheless, entrance into it could be difficult, but the results after that is because in previous post-bubble contractions, the gold sector has become the favorite. The gold's real price goes up, profitability comes back into gold mining, and also with gold's real price going up, it really helps with the valuations of gold discoveries, gold prospects, gold properties. So, hey, there's sunshine ahead for the sector, but how we get into it is going to be quite tricky.
Bob, what's going on with crude?
The excitement put crude up to 130 a couple of months ago, and then you have had all kinds of political things going on, and it's been weakening, although up a 3% or today. And that's quite all right, because often crude seasonality can be favorable during the summer, and then after, let's say, mid-September, we'll take a look at it, because oftentimes you can have a dismal low for crude oil in January, February, And, oh, yeah, speaking of seasonality, you can you get a good seasonal high for copper in March, which we got, then a test of that in July, which we ain't getting, and then a copper often has a low in November. Lumber can have a high in June and then set a low in October. And then, as I say, crude's top seasonally is kind of be all over the place, but there's often chances of a dismal low for crude oil in January or February, and I think that that can happen. So we've got here now. The other trick in the post-bubble condition, Jim, is that the senior currency, which is still the U.S. dollar, it trends up in a post-bubble contraction, and it has been trending up. It's the DX, as we call it, has been quite firm for, well, it got up to 105 when the pressures were really on in May, and then corrected to 101.5, and now it's around 104. But we think after August, when the discovery of more credit problems, then the U.S. dollar could go up. And unfortunately, the Canadian dollar, being somewhat tied to commodities, could go down, and we've had a target on that one of 68 in dismal times, and it's really dreadful that with the central bank and the government we got federally here, you can't look for a sound Canadian currency. It's just not in the political mix, so, which is regrettable for all Canadians.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Yep, as I said, the U.S. up to the DX got up to 105 in May with the crisis, backed off to 101.5, and is now trading at the 104 level, which can trade here maybe into August, but with the next pressures in the financial markets that can break out beyond the 105 and maybe hit, who knows, 110 or something like that, it would be very painful for those who consider the U.S. dollar does nothing but go straight down.
Bob, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Jim, good to be with you, and it's been a fascinating week in the market, and I guess next week will be fascinating as well.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy, the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Our conversation took place on Friday the 24th. Coming up, Eric Haddock next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He's speaking to us from Central California. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Eric, could the stock markets continue heading higher into 2023, where Martin Armstrong's predicting 2023 to be a panic cycle?
I'm not sure or really aware of his predictions, but my work for the last several years, and it really kind of highlighted this throughout 2021, was showing me that 2022 should be a major top in the stock market. And I kind of broke that down into everything from multi-generational cycles, that you had this classic textbook cycle progression on a 40-year basis. And the cycle progression is a tool that I developed just to understand the cycle evolution, but also where it's most a cycle is most likely to invert. And so on a 40-year basis, you had these major lows in the stock market, dating back to the 1800s. And then 1942, you saw a major one, then 1982, and that 40-year cycle was showing that from 82 to 2022 should just be a complete up wave as opposed to a cycle, which is a high to a low to a high or a low to a high to a low. This would just be a wave, which is half of a cycle, and form a major top in 2022, 40 years later. And one of the things that I look to validate or reinforce cycles like that is similar action at their midpoint. And so you had this 20-year cycle that broke down and was projecting the same thing, dealing with your low in 82, then a major low in 2002, and projecting a subsequent high in 2022. Then you had a 10-year cycle, the midpoint of that 20-year cycle break down and do something similar. And so that was the big broad cycle, but for the last several years, I've focused on this almost uncanny 8-month cycle in the stock market, and it's 2x multiple, a 16-month cycle in the stock market. And when we came through May of last year and a lot of the small cap indexes and some of your weaker indexes peaked at that time, it was fulfilling the next phase of this 8-month cycle and projecting a final high and a much sharper sell-off come early January 2022, exactly 8 months after those markets had peaked. You had the same sequence of cycles breaking down to where that 8-month cycle was reinforced by an intervening 4-month cycle. And so in early September, you saw a corresponding or corroborating high, which just reinforced now that you would have intervals of 4 months, 8 months coming into play in early January. And then that 4-month cycle broke down, and after seeing a peak in early September, then we saw a peak in early November when several key indexes hit their major highs and reached multi-year upside price objectives. And that just reinforced this whole idea that January 2022 would create a divergent peak where a few stocks, a few indexes were still able to spike to a new high, but I frequently correlated it to an old wooden roller coaster where you have several cars in the train on that roller coaster, and it's not till the final car goes over the summit that then the whole train speeds to the downside, and that's what we had in January of 2022. But those cycles also were projecting forward from that we should see a subsequent high, probably a lower high in September of 2022. And if that was going to be the case, then the most likely scenario is that the decline from January should last about 5.5 months, which is roughly 2/3 of that 8-month cycle. And what you get is a market declines for two portions of the cycle and then rebounds for one portion. So it's kind of like a 50% rebound in time. So in this case, the market should drop from that early January divergent peak for about 23 weeks and then rebound for about 11.5 weeks into September. And that's also pretty much exactly what we've seen, particularly if these recent lows of June hold. That will be the 5.5 month decline. Then we'll be poised for about a 2.75 month rebound, but after that, I think you enter an even more dangerous period. So as far as any new highs in 2023, right now my work's not showing that. I could certainly see a few divergent highs in this September, could even stretch into October, September-October 2022 time frame. But then you get into what I've talked about for many years, this 7-year crash cycle that timed, sometimes it was just a few months sharp drop and of at least 20-25%, often as much as 35-50%, and that timed lows in more recently in 2002, 2009, 2016, and 2023 is the next cycle in that series. So it kind of tells you two things. One is that should be the culmination of a sharp decline, and two, that it could also turn out to be a multi-year bottom.
How long do fifth waves last, and could the NASDAQ be starting one?
Well, that's that's a very general question that would need some other specifics, because there are fifth waves on multiple degrees. You can have a fifth wave on a 10-minute chart, then a fifth that forms a fifth wave on an hourly chart and a daily chart and a weekly, monthly. So fifth waves are, it all depends on the degree or the magnitude of structure, wave structure that you're talking about. I described and illustrated and warned about last November when I thought that the Russell 2000, the Dow Transportation, and the NASDAQ 100 were all setting fifth wave peaks, and that would drive some of their sharpest sell-offs in 2022 that they have seen in many years, other than that February-March 2020 spike to the downside. But so from a wave perspective, many of those indexes fulfilled fifth wave criteria in November of last year. And at the same time they were fulfilling those wave criteria, they were fulfilling the some of the cycles I just described. They were kind of some of the interim peaks, those that had peaked in May, other stocks and indexes in early September, then some of these key indexes in early November, and then the final Dow and S&P barely spiking to new highs in early January, and then the whole thing turned down. But so they had fulfilled timing, wave structure, and price. I had detailed, and I've gone back to it many times, this whole series of range trading intervals that some of these key markets had gone into. And in November, I posted a couple charts that were showing why the Russell 2000 should peak right around 2460 and ultimately make it back down to 1710. And it ended up peaking right by that 2460 level, and we just hit the 1710 in the last couple weeks. So it had fulfilled these major multi-year price upside targets too. So if anything, on a much broader scale, this whole sell-off in last year or early this year, depending on which stock or index you're talking about, that could even be a major A wave to the downside. Then you get a major B wave bounce, potentially peaking in September, October of this year. And then you're set up for the C wave decline. So unless there's a specific wave structure that I'm not addressing here, I think that several of your fifth waves have passed, and we're just in this whole phase of major corrections from those peaks.
How long could the interest rate cycle run before we see the peak in interest rates?
Well, one of the things I'm looking at there is similar to what I was describing about the 8-month cycle in the stock market. And when a trend is changing, often the breakdown of the decline and rally, or rally and decline, depending on which cycle you're coming off of, breaks down to where the first move off of that cycle. So when I was talking about stocks, the decline from that January cycle peak consumes about two-thirds of the prevailing cycle. So an 8-month cycle, 5.5 months, give or take. In interest rates, for many years, I've talked about this 4-year cycle that has just been so uncanny in bonds and notes and the corresponding interest rates, but for this discussion here, I'm referring to bonds, which are the inverse of interest rates. So bonds saw these, they went through a perfect cycle progression, or sequence, where they saw, bonds saw major lows at a 4-year interval, and then starting in 2008 and up into 2012, they saw a major peak right in the July-August time frame of 2012, then another one in July-August 2016, and that was projecting a final major top for bonds, so a low in interest rates, for July, August of 2020, which is exactly when interest rates bottomed and bonds peaked. We should see a subsequent lower peak in bonds, so that would equate to a higher low in interest rates, should see that in mid-2024 because of this four-year cycle. In between that 2020 interest rate low bond peak and the next in that series in 2024, I expected to see about a 2 3/4 year rally in interest rates, drop in bonds, which would be about 2/3 of that 4-year cycle. And that, along with a lot of corroborating cycles and timing indicators, told me to look for this a major advance in interest rates from July-August 2020 into the first quarter of 2023 before things peak in interest rates, and then you see a correction, could be a consolidation. Doesn't mean that they go straight down. It just means that the next multi-year low comes into play in that July-August 2024 time frame. And so far, everything that's happened in interest rates has just continued to reinforce that analysis and that outlook. So I'm still operating on that that overall conclusion that interest rates would head higher into first quarter of 2023, and that's when you will see a pretty significant peak. But prior to that, I was looking for a kind of penultimate peak, a peak before the final peak, right in this May-June time frame. So I'm thinking that interest rates could be setting a multi-month peak in here. And again, that doesn't mean that they drop sharply from there. All it means is that they stay below that low or that peak for at least 1 to 2 months. And that could just be a lot of sideways trading a little bit below that peak. And that gives time, both from a cycle standpoint and from a trading standpoint, for things to kind of even out and a new equilibrium to be found before you would see another move up in interest rates, potentially into a final peak in the early part of next year.
Recently, the stock markets have dropped into bear market territory, but could the bear market already be over?
Well, this particular phase of it, I would say, and I would go back to kind of that ABC wave structure that I mentioned a few minutes ago, that combined with multiple cycles, even the duration of these sell-offs has been remarkably similar to some key comparative sell-offs we saw. So all those factors together are telling me that this initial decline certainly could be close to or at a bottom, and that we could see a rebound and a consolidation phase in between this low, wherever it's set, a decent chance it already has been set in the last week or two. But between that and the highs of January, that I could see the markets whipping back and forth within that trading range for several months, but ultimately spiking to at least a 3 to 6 month high. So the highest level that stocks have seen in at least 3 months, perhaps 6 months, as you come into September, October. Doesn't mean that it would exceed the January highs. Doesn't mean that it would even exceed the early March highs. But that you should be able to look at a chart, look at price movement, and have seen a general uptrend from this current or developing low into a subsequent peak in, ideally, in early September.
Where is the U.S. dollar in its cycles?
I kind of come back to, a lot of times, this very consistent 38 to 41 month cycle that has governed the dollar for at least the last 30 plus years. And as we were coming into 20, 16, 17, and even the election. I know I discussed that with you as well, where my work was showing a major bottom in the dollar. And then in 2020, in between there, we had a rally back to the highs, very significant peak, then a sell-off into a low in early 2021, which was 3 years from, 3.25 years from the previous low. And all of that was showing that the dollar was ready for a new 2 year, rally from there. Once again, I kind of go back to that 2-to-1 ratio between the rally off of a cycle low and the subsequent pullback. So if we've got a 3+ year cycle, the rally from that, from a low, would often consume about 2 years or so. And along with a lot of other factors, including the next phase of the 3 year cycle from the previous high, the 2020 high, that also portends a pretty significant peak in the first half of 2023. And the fact that you've fulfilled a lot of the upside price objectives in the dollar, there's one more major upside target that I think will be hit after we see a few months of consolidation. But all that to say, my work has been showing that the first half of 2023 could be a major top in the U.S. dollar.
Eric, is there anything that we should be aware of when it comes to geocosmic cycles that could affect the markets?
Well, as we've talked about a lot before, certainly the solar cycle has had a very significant impact. And there's so many reasons why that makes sense. It doesn't have to be some ethereal, esoteric, type of mystical thing. It's a very physical, electromagnetic type of physical cycle and impact that it has. And when we saw the bottom in the solar cycle in late 2019, that ushered in what I thought would be a multi-year period of uncertainty and instability. In March of 2019, I described two things that I thought would begin that cycle, and I was projecting forward to early 2020 and describing why I thought we would see a stock panic cycle and what I called a global shaping event that coincided with these disease cycles that and influenza cycles I had described and documented for almost a decade. They were all coming into play in late 2019, early 2020. And as I described back then, I thought that was just the opening salvo in this period of increasing instability that I thought we would see from late 2019, early 2020 into 2024, 2025. I know you and I frequently discuss the war cycles that I was looking to kick back in late 2021. I think that that's even a factor of this solar cycle. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a direct cause and effect, but there are a lot of factors that coincide, and which is the ultimate cause, that, you know, everyone can debate that. I'm observing cycles and trying to take advantage of that knowledge in the best way possible. And one of the other things I described over the last couple of years was this recurring cycle of major solar storms. And I explained why I thought that 2022, 2023 would be the time frame for that cycle to reach fruition. And even getting a little more specific, I thought 2023, still think 2023 is the best chance for a major disruptive solar storm. And there again, exactly what, you know, that's not a Chicken Little sky is falling type of proclamation. That's just that these cycles are very consistent and they can create different types of disruption. And it may not be the U.S. It may be Europe, Middle East, Asia, that gets hit hardest. It's not always a global thing. In fact, rarely is it. There's certain areas that get hit harder than others due to multiple factors. But that's what I am looking for, and it kind of loosely ties in with many of these other cycles. If stocks were going to see a major peak in early 2022, secondary peak in third quarter of 2022, and then see this kind of crash cycle reach fruition in 2023, perhaps that coincides with some sort of disruptive event like that. Or they may be two completely different things. And the only reason that I even kind of hedge this a little bit is often when I'm discussing things like this, especially when I don't have a chance to lay out my entire case, there are many readers, listeners who kind of like to latch onto one part and hit the hyperbolic button, and all of a sudden it's the end of the world being discussed. And that's not the case. This is a cyclic thing that has happened over and over again for actually hundreds of years, especially the specific cycle that I documented in some of my articles. And I would just naturally expect it to recur in 2023.
Eric, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Eric Haddock, CEO and president of InsideTrackTrading.com. He was speaking to us from the Fresno area of Central California. Coming up, John Kaiser, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Kaiser, CEO and president of Kaiser Research. He's speaking to us from California. Welcome back to This Week in Money, John.
Jim, thank you for having me on your show.
How are things going at Kaiser Research and on Kaiser Watch?
Well, Kaiser Research is doing just fine, continues to cover all the Australian Canadian listed companies. And Kaiser Watch, since we've launched it in mid-January, we've done 23 episodes. We've managed to attract 300-plus subscribers on the YouTube channel. But for those of you on the YouTube channel, make sure you also follow Kaiser Research on Twitter, because the YouTube channel is basically an audio show. And what I do is when I can post it, I also do a blog comment, which includes graphics that help illustrate what I'm talking about. And then I tweet the link to my Twitter followers so that they can, at their leisure, click on it and find those questions that they want to listen to on the YouTube channel, and also see the graphics associated for it. So, yes, it's going great. I'm very pleased that I've launched Kaiser Watch as a sort of a new medium to talk to people out there who aren't members of Kaiser Research.
You were just at PDAC 2022 in Toronto. How was the attendance and the mood there?
Well, the official number was 17,455 delegates. Normal has been in the 25,000 to 30,000 range. Obviously, last year it didn't happen. And what was astonishing was the mood of the people there. They didn't quite figure out the logistics. On opening day, Monday, people who hadn't picked up their badge weren't allowed in until about after 1 o'clock. So they missed a half day of walking the floor and visiting companies. And the crazy part was everybody showed up for the opening at 10 o'clock, and where they had the people pick up their badges, that created a bottleneck. And then all the other people who already had their badges got stuck in there. And then the health and safety people went crazy and kicked everybody out and started metering in the people. And I did a Pieces of Eight roundtable with seven other newsletter writers hosted by Peter Bodish. I managed to get in through a back door with a borrowed pass. And I talked to a Hall 801, which was about a quarter full, and it seemed kind of like, oh, this is really lame. I guess it's going to be a bowling alley when I get out there into the investors exchange and trade show floor. But when I did, the place was booming. It's been a long time since I've had to be very careful how I navigate the aisles between the booths without bumping into people. What's interesting is they have color-coded their badges. There are the orange exhibitor badges, then there are the blue all-access badges, and then there are the green sort of day pass badges where you pay $25 a day to be able to go in there. You can't listen to any of the technical talks, but you can visit companies in both the trade show and the investors exchange. The green badge people, the people who represent money, maybe brokers who just showed up for a day during the day, they were not very frequent. So this was industry coming out, because the all-access pass costs $500 to $800, and that's usually paid for by your boss, your company, or whatever, for you to be there. But it was really, really good to see that everybody was in good spirits and that it was so busy. And the companies who were expecting a more, they had an incredible amount of traffic, even though it was only, you know, a fraction of that represented potential money coming into the sector. So the industry is alive and well, and PDAC had a great three-day session.
At PDAC, were there any mining sectors that people were really excited about?
You know, it was really hard to pick up any sort of theme, because you had to talk to people to find out what they were referencing. And in most cases, they're referencing what it is that they're involved with. So they're talking about their copper play or their gold play or their lithium play. So there wasn't any distinct, sector that was creating a buzz. There was a general view that the world does have a supply problem with the splitting of the world into two geopolitically distinct sectors, you know, the China-Russia axis representing the autocrats, and the United States and the European representing democracy. And with so much raw material coming from the China-Russia axis, there's a sense that there's going to have to be a lot of money going into projects in the more secure jurisdictions of the world. But the one thing that I did find interesting, and again, this may be myself just, echoing my own observation, is that there were a lot of lithium companies presenting there, and they were getting a lot of attention. And another sector, rare earths, I talked to one company who has been there for a number of years. They have a rare earth prospect, and he says for the first time, people were actually stopping by to ask about, okay, where are you with your rare earth project? What are you chasing? When are things going to happen? So this idea of critical minerals, that was lurking in the background. And given that it was the sort of industry type people who are starting to think, where are we going to get all this stuff from, that they were pounding the floor at PDAC, this was a good sign, which, encourages me to continue with my theme of Lithium Mania 2.0.
Without mentioning names, those are for your subscribers. Did you find any potential bottom fish candidates at PDAC?
Yeah, Jim, not for the best reasons in the world. In November, December, I put together 175 bottom fish candidates by going through my Kaiser Research search engine and finding companies that had been beaten up and put that together. But this year has been pretty dismal for resource juniors. Even though they should buck the trend with the general equity market decline, they have suffered collateral damage. And now that we're seeing the interest rate hikes are relentlessly pushing higher, with engineering a recession, maybe even a depression to crush this inflation, which isn't entirely due to the quantitative easing of the last decade. This has put a lot of stocks that were too high to qualify as bottom fish into price levels, and I would be walking by the booth and I'd recognize this company and I'd see, why are you guys so cheap? Oh my gosh, I need to talk to you guys and figure out what your story is, where you are. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of new companies that I'm going to have to add to my bottom fish collection during the summer, because the summer doldrums are looking rather dismal for the Resource Juniors as it stands right now.
What do you look for in potential bottom fish candidates?
Well, what I'm looking for is some sort of missing piece that explains why what appears to be a good story isn't getting traction in the market. And that could be something like a permitting timeline. It could be a funding problem. It could be a marketing deficiency on management's part. Or it could be in exploration place. They just need to push the project through the next level of exploration to confirm the hypothesis that they've developed. And the cheapness, I try to pin down what is the missing piece, which, if that piece fell into place, should enable the stock to develop an uptrend. And this is what I try to do when I tag these companies as bottom fish. What is the missing piece that is holding the stock down, and what is the likelihood and what is required to have this missing piece disappear and have this stock develop an uptrend and attract an audience that gives it at least a fair valuation rather than sort of a bottom fish type valuation.
On your KaiserResearch.com website, how do you rate junior mining companies?
Well, the majority of companies that I haven't looked at closely, they are simply unrated. But I have a scheme for those companies that I've looked at, and it's called bottom fish, fair, poor, fair, and good speculative value. And good speculative value is a company that actually has all the missing pieces in place. The story's strong. You crunch the numbers. It's undervalued relative to where it should be in fair value terms. But for some reason, there's an inefficiency in the market's understanding of the company. Bottom fish, as I've mentioned in an earlier question, that's where there is a decent story, but there is a missing piece that's inhibiting the company from attracting more eyeballs. Now, poor speculative value, that's actually companies that have been very successful at promoting their story. They have a good audience, and they already have a lot of success embedded in the valuation. And poor speculative value, well, that's, you know, when the company's so high priced and so successful, I don't see any significant upside. I see more downside from things going wrong than from the positive things being confirmed by the fundamentals. And the sweet spot in the middle is fair speculative value, where, you know, you're at the mercy of what is the gold price going to be, what are the exploration results going to be in terms of the stage of the project and the what one can project as the potential future value outcome. It is fairly priced based on my rational speculation model, which uses an uncertainty ladder to price a future outcome based on the stage of the project at the current moment.
How easy is the KaiserResearch.com website to use?
It is made for sophisticated investors. We compile an awful lot of information covering capital structure, who the people are, where the projects are, what they are. And if you don't know anything about the sector, you're going to be bewildered by all this. So you pull up some ABC company and you see all this stuff. And for me, I look at it and immediately, bing, 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 I recognize this. Okay, here's a problem. Oh, here's a virtue. To me, it's like saving me enormous amounts of time digging up the information by going to the website or SEDAR and going through documents and compiling it all together. So for sophisticated investors, Kaiser Research is an absolute charm to use, especially with the search engine where you can put company and project level criteria together to make very, very focused searches. And then the deep dive that you do, you're not wasting your time simply creating a short list, the short list you generate by yourself. But that's why I also have, you know, the bottom fish collection and the trackers to discuss about the ones that I've already curated as of being interest. So for those investors, you know, who don't want to do their own homework, there's plenty of material and ideas to follow. And we have a sort of a running commentary in the Parallel Slack forum. And for those people, they do need to learn the jargon, because I'm not just saying, trust me, it's going higher by now type of thing, which is, you know, totally worthless worthless analysis. I do try to explain all my assumptions in that. And that can be tedious to people who just want a momentum idea that they can jump on and ride until it goes higher. We're not in a very good momentum market because momentum's on the downside, if anything. So you now do need to be a stock picker, understand why you own this stuff, place your bet, and wait for the events to happen that deliver the expected fundamental outcome.
Pros and cons, KaiserResearch.com website versus newsletter writers.
Well, the problem that's sort of descended upon the newsletter business is that people really don't want to pay money for what constitutes as analytical advice about, say, resource juniors. And even when there is decent advice available, it gets compromised because somebody will post it in some forum, online forum, for everybody else to see for nothing. So the business model behind a sort of a subscription fee-based newsletter, that is in serious trouble, which is why you see a lot of newsletters that are free, and they're giving ideas about stocks that are, you know, supposed to do good, and they like the company and all that. But the business model is that they're actually being paid by the companies to like the company. And, of course, when that payment stops for whatever reason, then they suddenly discover reasons not to like the company. So the newsletter business has become sketchy. If it's free, you have to be cautious about it. That's why I, with Kaiser Research, the favorites are the companies where the missing pieces have all pretty much disappeared, where the company is reasonably robust and the pricing is not dirt cheap like a bottom fish anymore. So those I make available free to the audience out there. They are like graduates from the bottom fish collection, and paying people what they're really, insofar as they're not just using it to research their own ideas, they are paying for the privilege of seeing these curated bottom fish collection companies and following our conversations about it and our discussions about, okay, what's happening, is it finally getting into the zone where it can become a popular favorite that needs to be unrestricted. And an important thing that I developed 5 years ago or so was I developed a Slack forum where we have about 30 channels that are sort of theme-based. And the subscribers that are paying members, they get to be members of this also. And this has become very interesting because I can't keep track of all these things myself. So my subscribers actually become a talent pool for me. They are posting stuff saying, oh, John, did you see this news release? Or did you see this article? Is this bad news for one of our favorites? So it's a way of leveraging my research activity beyond just compiling all this information and having, you know, a collaborative system where the whole group of us, most of the people are just lurkers, but there's maybe 5% or so who actually do post. And this is something that's sort of an innovation that's different from, you know, your traditional newsletter where you're just pushing your ideas and that at a passive audience. It's become more of an interactive type of system.
Are there area plays you're keeping an eye on?
You know, area plays used to be just proximity. Like the classic ones was, Moisey's Bay nickel discovery in 1994, and then everything around it gets staked. And until you've demonstrated otherwise, the glass is 90% full, and you get a lot of money pouring in, a lot of exploration activity done. Sometimes additional discoveries are made. In the case of Voisey's Bay, it wasn't. Then there's the other ones, which are something of a conceptual nature, which in the 1990s was the diamond discoveries at Lac de Gras by Diamet. And that unleashed a staking spree that, you know, covered the entire Slave Craton, which was sort of the equivalent size of Switzerland. And then it spread to other parts of Canada and even other parts of the world as everybody suddenly got up the learning curve of what diamonds were all about. And diamonds back then were an $8 billion market in rough diamond production. Today it's about $15 billion. And it's a sector that basically tracks the macroeconomic trend. And that was a huge sort of conceptual area play. Yes, the proximity companies ended up doing quite well, but it also ended up stimulating discoveries elsewhere, and people really got into the diamond sector. The diamond sector only has a handful of companies still plugging away, hoping to find something significant. But the big conceptual area play that I see emerging, and I mentioned Lithium Mania 2.0 earlier, this is Eastern Canada's pegmatite potential. Now, right now, lithium comes from either the lithium triangle of brines in South America or from the pegmatites in Western Australia. And Canada has a bounty that's at least equal, if not better, to what exists in Western Australia. The difference is Western Australia is pretty dry and scraped clean, and you can see what's sticking out of the ground. Pegmatites are very difficult to detect with geophysics or any other methods if they are covered. In Canada, we have swamp and bush and overburdened gravel covering everything, but over the decades, they have still found these pegmatites here. And because lithium has been this tiny market all these decades, first serving the glass ceramic market, then, you know, a bit more when cell phones and laptop lithium ion batteries started being adopted. But the huge thing that's happening now is this idea that by 2035-40, electric vehicles will replace the internal combustion engine car fleet. You know, that's still, you know, 12, 14 years down the road, and the curve has not really yet gone exponential, but estimates have been done that the lithium ion battery, and we don't know what the configuration will be for the cathode and the anode down the road, but we do know that lithium is a significant part of the electrolyte, and the projection is that after expanding three or four times in the last 5 years in terms of global supply, it needs to expand another 10 times to meet the lithium requirements if this fantasy of electric cars replacing ICE cars is to become reality. And some of that will come from the lithium triangle brines. Some will come from these deeper brines in the oil patch where they're using direct lithium extraction techniques. And some will come from the pegmatite fields in Western Australia. And Goldman Sachs put out some story that China, over the next few years, is set to expand its lithium supply fivefold to put it on a par with Australian supply from its relatively inferior pegmatites and inferior brine systems. I don't think that's going to happen, but I do see significant potential from the Western Australia and the lithium triangle. However, these areas are water challenged, and as the temperature continues to rise, water is going to become an increasingly important factor in lithium supply, which leaves Eastern Canada, where it has this incredible bounty. They know roughly where the trends are, where these pegmatite bodies that are fertile with lithium formed, and there's now a scramble afoot nail down these trends. Many of the known pegmatites have already been picked off with postage stamp type claims by existing juniors. But I see that as the world realizes that the electric vehicle rollout's a fantasy, unless there's this tremendous, like 500,000 tons of new pegmatite supply coming from Eastern Canada, and there's plenty of time because the inflection point really won't happen until the end of this decade. So I see a tremendous pegmatite boom happening now in Eastern Canada, where there's plenty of water. Pegmatites are relatively simple compared to, say, orogenic gold deposits, which are really squirrely and you get your high-grade intersection, but you never know what you have. The market at the moment doesn't really know how to quantify the rock value of an intersection, but that's going to be relatively easy to teach. And I see this as a huge teaching gateway to the younger generations, the millennials, who do care whether or not EV cars replace ICE cars, because it's part of the solution to, mitigating climate change, slowing the rate of global warming, so that they and their children and grandchildren have a future. Whereas, you know, older generations, boomers such as myself, well, we probably won't experience the worst of what's to come. So, you know, we're inclined to not care so much. But this younger generation, they need to care about lithium, because the EV replacement is not going to happen unless massive new supply is going to be mobilized, and Eastern Canada is the place where at least half of the future supply that's required is going to have to come from.
Is the increase in energy costs putting upward pressure on commodity prices?
Well, the increase in energy cost is putting pressure on the profitability of mining operations. We have two factors at play right now. We have China's zero COVID policy, which is slowing demand from China, and this is starting to impact the commodity prices. And then we have, you know, the visible inflation. Only part of it's due to too much money having been created through quantitative easing. A lot of it is due to supply chain bottlenecks that have not yet resolved. China is doing absolutely nothing to make production flow more smoothly. And now we have this additional problem of, the Russia invasion of Ukraine disrupting other supply chains. So we have a very entrenched inflation situation that would take a number of years to unwind, and very positive things to happen on the Russian front and the Chinese front for these inflationary pressures to go down. So we have the Federal Reserve saying, okay, now we need to hike up the interest rates, take it way up, crash the real estate market, take the wind out of the sails of these younger people who think that they can set the terms for their employment. Yeah, we need to take everybody down, create a recession. And that's, of course, putting pressure on metal prices, which are starting to feel the pressure from all these fronts. And at the same time, the high energy costs created by the Russian sanctions and the reluctance of, say, the American shale oil frackers to really get going again, because they got crushed so badly during the 2020 Russia-Saudi Arabia supply glut that they deliberately orchestrated, but just had the bad timing of doing it when COVID broke out. We are going to see these high energy prices erode profitability even as the commodity prices go down. Longer term, commodity prices have to go up because the world is splitting into separate geopolitical jurisdictions where trade of raw materials whose supply is skewed to the autocratic portion, it's going to be diminished. Sanctions will probably be a long-term part of the future. And so we will see higher commodity prices down the road, not just from higher energy costs, but because of the need to find a new place to produce raw materials in jurisdictions that are not vulnerable to extortion, such as we're now seeing coming out of Russia.
There's a significant push for more electric vehicles. Is this a tailwind for the lithium-ion battery metals sector?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, the Rio Tinto talks about needing 60 more Jadar deposits. And Jadar deposit is a new type of lithium deposit they discovered in Serbia. It's world-class, but it's stalled right now because of politics and corruption. And Rio Tinto has come out and said, if based on the current requirements for lithium and the EV replacement of the ICE fleet, we're going to need 60 Jadars producing by 2035. So insofar as that you believe the electric vehicles will continue to be, expand, there was definitely a tailwind pushing interest in lithium. Now, at the same time, we had a strong year for lithium stocks, but there's currently a bear attack. Goldman Sachs, even though they're very bullish long-term on lithium, they've decided to create a short-term downtrend. One wonders what the real reason behind this is. They've got two analysts in their China Basic Materials division who have come up with this idea that China's going to glut the market in the same way Australia did in 2015 to 2018, when they managed to tank the lithium carbonate price from its $10-$12 per pound range all the way down to $3 a pound range, where nothing works. And so we had that slump in the whole sector. This year, starting last year, it's gone into the $30 to $35 per pound range, and everything's, oh, this is wonderful, everything's in the money. But but it's not wonderful because at that price, you're never going to see the electric vehicle replacement happen because the car just won't be affordable to the masses who are supposed to buy all these electric vehicles. So kind of perversely, watching the lithium carbonate price sink back to the $10 to $15 per pound range is actually a good thing. Normally, this makes everybody say, oh, the bubble's over, got to run. But no, between $10 and $15, these pegmatites that are grading 1% plus lithium oxide, they're in the money. You just need to figure out, okay, what's their mineability? How big are they? How far are they from a future hydroxide refinery? So, I think it's a tremendous moment. And the downside risk is that we do sink into a capitulation of sorts where we accept the end times. The world is going to get lousier. It's going to heat. Climate change is going to have ever more extreme weather events. The ocean's going to rise. Miami's going to disappear because of the higher water. And we just accept it, in which case, that's what I call Twilight's last gleam. That's where I think gold will flourish, because as people give up about the future and just resign themselves, they'll start to focus on gold as sort of something to hold on to as the whole world starts to break apart at the seams all over the place.
As cryptos implode, do you think more money will be attracted to mining?
Well, I'm the kind of person who would like to see cryptos implode. I don't think they will implode and disappear, go to zero, even though they should. A Bitcoin really refers to nothing except itself. I liken it to, an OTC bulletin board company where all this paper is manufactured very cheap for the insiders, and then they invent some story about how wonderful the future for this company is, and they just start promoting it all over the place. And this is kind of what's happened to Bitcoin. And it had a trillion-dollar plus value at one point, and based on what? Well, it's supposed to replace the U.S. dollar. Well, as long as it's priced in U.S. dollar, I don't think so. But what was implicit in this was this idea that along the way, as the value of these holdings from these whales that bought this earlier would continue to expand, there would be boomers such as myself whom Wall Street would trick into swapping my bonds and cash and whatever into owning Bitcoin at these massively inflated prices that really don't represent anything at all. And in a sense, this would be a good thing because it's a massive wealth transfer from stagnant wealth that the boomers have accumulated, and you transfer it to these younger people who own all this Bitcoin, which is really intrinsically worth nothing, but you swap it for the real cash that the boomers are sitting on, not doing much with, and maybe this cash will then be invested in the economy, into these, energy transition technologies, and actually do a good thing. But I don't think that's really going to happen. I think right now we're seeing that the momentum game is over. The creation of money through quantitative easing, that's now in reverse. And so we're seeing it, the cryptos, some of them just truly implode, like these lesser ones, Bitcoin simply sinking lower. And that's not going to help the mining sector, because the money that went into that was never really money that was available for the resource sector. The resource sector is kind of this archaic sector that the boomers know about, but the younger generations do not. And these people have experienced a monster wealth effect, but they weren't, insofar as they were converting their Bitcoin into cash, they were putting it into other areas. So as we get this reverse wealth effect, we're just going to see all the Johnny-come-latelys get blown up, but they're not going to have any money left. They're not going to discover the resource sector and put money in there. The boomers who were gold bugs that decided, Bitcoin is the new gold, those ones, they will still have cash left over. They may come back to the resource sector, but simply deflating the value of the various cryptocurrencies, that by itself is not going to redirect money into the mining sector. The inflow of money has to come from younger generations realizing that the raw material supply that's in the pipeline is inadequate to suit the needs of their future.
Are there reasons to be bullish on the junior mining sectors this summer and fall?
These interest rate hikes are going to persist, and each time we get a three-quarter point hike, we're going to see the market smash down, and the resource juniors are going to be collateral damage. People are going to see the retreating base metal prices and take that as a cue to be negative about the sector. I think from a longer-term perspective, this is a very good summer to start focusing on the resource juniors. And if you're going to prioritize anything, look for companies that actually have an exploration program permitted, funded, and underway that will start flowing results either this summer or sometime in the fourth quarter, when September comes around, to fuel the market's interest. Because right now the market is shunning companies that are static, that don't have a permit, that don't have money, that don't have a drill program. If nothing's going to change about the fundamentals of the company, you're not going to attract any money. And for companies where it's only a matter of time for them to get their act together, get the permit, this is a good accumulation window. But that's not the same as being bullish. Bullish means, okay, everything's going to be trending up and people are going to be piling in. No, this summer and possibly even into the fall is going to be an accumulation period. I think the upside will come next year when they finished with their interest rate hikes and are starting to think we've overdone it and we need to reduce it. That's when I think we will see the resource sector really flourish with an emerging bull market.
John, where can people subscribe to Kaiser Research and how much does it cost to do it?
Just go to kaiserresearch.com. It's $450 US a year for an individual membership that gives you access to the entire search engine and all the online resources. And it also gives you access to the Slack forum that runs in parallel to Kaiser Research, where we engage in this sort of interactive, collaborative quest to find those bottom fish that are going to come to life over the next year.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. You're welcome.
My guest has been John Kaiser, the CEO of KaiserResearch.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Bob Hoy, Eric Haddock, and John Kaiser. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.